Dave Player on 720 WGN. After all that, this man need no introduction. He's celebrating three decades in radio, almost 20 years in Chicago. He's got a new book out called Broken Mary, A Journey of Hope. He's a legend in Chicago. He's a true radio genius. He is Kevin Matthews. Kevin, what's up, my friend?
Hey now, Dave. Hello, Chicago. I'm back.
You are back. Yeah. Congratulations on the new book, and I really do appreciate you saying yes to this conversation
today. Oh, I my pleasure. It's really good. I have so much love and respect for the people that work inside those studios at WGN. I really thank you, because I'm really proud of this book, and it's a way to let people know.
Well, I've been a loyal listener, you know, all my life, and especially in the days of the Classic Loop lineup of Brandmeier and Kevin Matthews and Steve and Gary, a fan of yours since you landed here in 86, and you pushed your conversations and your entertainment to the edge and made your shows a destination for laughter every day, and I have so much admiration for you. One man to another, is it wrong?
No. You got to remember, Howard Stern was part of that lineup, too.
Yeah, he was.
You know, Johnny and Steve and Gary and the folks, it was a really special time culturally in America. What I loved most is here we are in Chicago in the Hancock Building. Radio stations, managers, and program directors would send in their new morning shows or afternoon shows to get a hotel room out by O'Hare and listen to everyone and take everyone's material, which I don't mind, but we revolutionized entertainment radio, talk radio.
It was different. It was appointment listening. Like, just as a listener, I just remember turning it on at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and it didn't go off until 7, 8 o'clock at night.
It was unbelievable, the ratings. And you got to remember, we all started over on the Loop FM.
Right.
And that's when Jimmy DeCastro had a genius idea to buy CFL AM 1000, a monster coverage in the United States, 42 states and Canada. And no one was listening to the AM, you know, especially younger people, and we just moved a massive audience over to the AM dial. And when I first started, I was working at night, and just to think that I was getting in downtown New York, you know.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, the signal, sometimes we'd get a call from San Francisco, which means it was an amplified radio signal. It went around the world and came back to the transmitter. It was like driving a vintage muscle car. It was awesome.
Well, you know, there wasn't much talk radio going on. I mean, you got a little bit in the morning. GN was here. But, you know, there wasn't something contemporary for a younger generation. And that's what Jimmy and Larry and the gang really established there. It was just something for us.
Yeah, it truly was. Yeah, it was tremendous. I was thinking about that today. I miss talking to the audience. I was at Grant Park a couple of weeks ago, and I ran into cops that I had on the air with me when they were rookies. And I really miss talking to Chicago.
You had a great audience there. I know Pugs interviewed you during the taste and stuff. That was a great it was a great conversation. And people, you know, people are hungry for listening to Kev Matthews. And that's why I pulled together, you know, I think I told you off air earlier in the week that, you know, I found all my Kev Head tapes and Best of Jim Shorts and the engineers, Adam here, converted them all to digital files so that we could shoot some of these and play some of these classic bits.
Right. You know, I got to get dubs of that because I don't even have this stuff.
I will get it over to you for sure. I will give it over to you for sure. But, you know, your path to Chicago, you know, it's in radio. We're going to get to your book a little bit later. But your path to Chicago in radio, you started off at Grand Valley State College, where they had a radio station, WSRX, 10 watts of pure radio entertainment there.
Yep.
And you got a gig on overnights. How did that all happen?
Yeah, I went to Grand Valley. I followed a really beautiful girl that I loved, Diane. She was going to go to Grand Valley, so I decided, well, I'll go to Grand Valley. And then I went to Grand Valley, and she dusted me like an end table. And so here I am in the middle of, okay, I don't even know where Grand Valley is, but I'm a student now, and I was going to go into education, and my roommate, who had long hair down to his ass, and he had pot plants. I got into my dorm room. I noticed, wow, he's got pot plants, and he was a med student. And he worked at the radio station, this college student-run radio station. And I started to listen, and I said, hey, you know, if you need any help, you know, like writing public service announcements, I'd like to come on down. And I did, and it all started one night. My first night, the student program director, he was rushed to the hospital because he had paraquat poisoning.
Oh my God.
Richard Nixon used to spray marijuana fields in Mexico and Texas with paraquat. Well, he got it. It wrecked his lungs. He was also overdosing on acid.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So they go, hey, can you do a show? And I go, no, I don't know how to run the equipment. Doesn't matter. Just come in. It's just got to be jazz.
Oh, my God.
And see, we got this jazz, and I pull out this album. I see, wow, John Coltrane. I wonder what this sounds like. Wow, Miles Davis. You know, it was, and I was able to do anything I wanted to. I really sucked that night. I hardly talked. Because the records, I didn't know how to cue up everything. Yeah. But that's what it was. We were listening to everything.
Trial by fire.
Yeah, we were, you know, the first to play like the Sex Pistols in America, because we were getting all this British punk music while America's into disco. We're getting Madness, the Specials,
sure.
Sex Pistols, everything, Clash, and we're playing this all on British imports, and it was just a great radio station.
In Kevin Matthews' new book, Broken Mary, he reveals his entire life, except for what really happened at the Kevin Matthews golf outings. Yes, don't go anywhere. The Kevin Matthews celebration continues on the Dave Plyer Show, 720 WGN.
Dave Plyer, WGN.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to radio legend Kevin Matthews. Now, after Grand Rapids, you went to St. Louis, and there's great stories there, too. But the Loop came calling, and you were sending stuff to Steve and Gary, and you got a call from Greg Salk at the time, and DeCastro flew you up on a plane, and that's how kind of things started rolling for you.
Yeah, I was so bored. The radio station was so bad in St. Louis, nobody listened to it, and I just decided, I'm going to do Ronald Reagan. Because I could do him really well, and I'll send it up to Steve and Gary, you know, hoping and that they would hear it. They did. They liked it. I got fired in St. Louis. It wasn't even 9 months, and I'm out of a gig. And Greg Salk called me and said, hey, do you want to come on up, and then we want to talk to you in Chicago at the Loop? And I said, no, I want to go back to Michigan. And I pretty much hung up the phone. He called me again, and I said, really, I want to know. And then he called my wife.
Brilliant.
Well, Jimmy also flew us up from St. Louis on a 747 commercial, TWA, into O'Hare. I'd never been on one of those. He had a car pick us up, take us to the Hancock. Here we go up to the 35th floor. Mm-hmm. And I loved him. You could tell how, when he was honest and he was one of us, and he just said, here, he wrote it out, this is what I'm going to pay you. And I said, no, that's great. That's what I'm making in St. Louis. I was doing mornings. And that was it. And we went over to the Palm and boozed it up and celebrated, and the rest is history.
Well, and I know after St. Louis, too, because I remember you talking about this on the air a little bit, 20 years ago, or that, you know, you were kind of sick of radio, and St. Louis really left a bad taste in your mouth, and working for the Jimmys and the Larrys, it was different. It was different up here because they really supported you and wanted you to be the best you could be and just be yourself.
Yeah, and don't forget, after college radio, I went into commercial radio in Grand Rapids, and our show kicked ass. We had 43% of the city listening every day.
Wow.
And so we were very successful. I was only making $12,000 a year.
Nice.
And then I, you know, was offered the gig in St. Louis. That fell through. And I wanted to go back to Michigan. And that's where I said to Greg, nah, I think I'm just going to go back to Michigan. And I'm so glad I didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, and for us listeners that listen to you, we knew you really cared about the audience. I think that's what made it so special. But you put on a performance, and you still do, by the way. It wasn't talk radio. It was like a play. It was like a Broadway play, a performance with all your characters, all your friends from the comedy clubs that helped develop some of those characters. And because you embodied what radio used to be in the early days, because listening to you was very much theater of the mind. Like, I kind of knew in my own head what Jim Shorts looked like.
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so I think I when I'm finally got an image of what I think Jim looks like, and I put him out there to the public, they go, "Oh yeah, that's Jim. That's what I think too."
Yeah,
yeah. And it was just, I loved it because no one told me no. You know, I basically just do what you do, and I wish radio would do that today. It's all about content. You
know,
people want to be entertained. It's as simple as that. And so it was so much freedom. It was beautiful.
And that's what you did. So, you know, I'm just thinking some of the characters of, as I'm listening to some of these tapes, you know, besides Jim, you know, he had a whole family, you know, Wang, his parents, Dad and Kiki, baby Luger. You know, I remember, as my cousins and I were talking about it this week, that his brother was decapitated by driving a Ski-Doo.
Yeah. My parents actually were Jim's parents. It was really fun to just bring all these characters, and I was doing really good impressions too. It was Sammy Davis Jr. I can remember.
Oh, yeah.
I found a guy would come in and videotape me on at night, and I was calling Bob Hope's house and I was talking to one of his housemaids. I didn't want to talk to Bob. I was talking as Sammy. You know, hey, can you make sure, you know, Bob gets this message? How are you? What's your name? Da-da-da-da-da. And it was just running with it, you know? It was just running with it.
I got to go back and say, the Jim Short's parents, Dad and Kiki, those were your parents?
Yeah, they were my parents. And another thing that I've always wanted to do, and I want to, you know, somebody like television, like Larry Wirt, who someone needs to do a documentary on AM 1000. Because AM 1000 was the home of us. Also, you could hear the Chicago Bulls and that new kid, Michael Jordan. And it was such a culture station, you know. It should be documented.
Well, and this is really the first thing that has done any of that is your book. Steve just wrote a book on disco demolition, but it's finally gotten to the point where we're starting to read a little bit about that stuff. But I agree with you. That was just a different era in radio broadcasting. It deserves to be told.
It was, because what we did with the Chicago Bears at that time, you know, the 85 Bears, they were allies of us. You know, we had this big family of athletes and entertainers, and you listen to it because that was Chicago. You want to hear Chicago? AM 1000.
More with Kevin Matthews after the news next on 720 WGN.
Dave Flyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to Chicago radio legend Kevin Matthews about his life behind the mic in his new book, Broken Mary, A Journey of Hope.
Right.
You had so many people on the show, too, that were so important to you and have done really well in radio. I mean, a lot of these guys are still in it.
Yeah, you know, and it's somebody, you know, because I started doing stand-up when I was real young, like 1982, and I just did an open mic night, and then I came back, and then I got to meet, you know, I was working with Tim Allen. Nobody knew Tim. Or Jerry Seinfeld. Seinfeld hadn't hit yet. And eventually worked with Bill Hicks a lot, who Bill was Sam Kennison's roommate. And I would work, every time Bill came in the area, I would open for Bill. And I loved it because he and I would bounce stuff off each other. And he was really, became a really good friend. He was devastated when David Letterman edited his entire setup.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
And he called me on the air the next morning, devastated, you know, and I to this day, I can't forgive David Letterman at all.
For doing that, yeah. The Bears were such a big part. Johnny Red Kerr, Keith Magnuson. I remember, and again, talked about this with some folks this week. When they came in the studio, they beat the hell out of you and then duct taped you to your chair.
It was Steve McMichael, Thayer, and Kevin Butler and their wives came up, duct taped me to a chair. McMichael took a knife and cut my shirt off, and then Kathy Butler, she put lipstick all over my head and face, and then Thayer started hitting one side of my shoulder, Mongo on the other. And I'm going to Thayer, I'm mumbling, "Is that all you can got?" And then they just beat me to a pulp. And then they wheeled me, took me in the elevator, and just threw me out on the street of, at Chestnut in Michigan there. And they left. And all these people were, "Look at that idiot. He's in a chair."
But this was on the air.
Yeah. Oh, this was on the air. Yeah. Yeah.
Incredible. And you had quite a relationship with Johnny Red Kerr as well.
John, Johnny Redker was really like, he was a dad to me. I loved him dearly, and he was such a beautiful human being. And I loved Johnny like a dad. And Keith Magnuson, I loved like a dad, too. And Keith and I would get in so much trouble together, man. We were always in the doghouse with our wives. And actually, when the old stadium, they were knocking it down, I skated with the Blackhawk alumni as a member. And it was the last night of the skate, and we went into the governor's room and did a toast, and then they knocked the stadium down. But I wanted to buy half of the penalty box and give it to Keith, because every time I took Keith out, we'd get into so much trouble. And, you know, I loved that man. I truly loved Maggie.
Well, and all these people were so much part of the show, though. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I knew your wife. I knew your kids. I knew Trevor. I knew Teague. I knew Deb. All your good friends. But then, you know, the Dorothy Humphreys, the Shemps, the Docs, the Chungas. I mean, all these folks. It was just part of your life every single day to tune in and listen.
Yeah, I know it. Chunga. Yeah, all these folks that I'd give nicknames to. We were all young. We all grew up. Everybody knew everybody because it was, I never wanted to be above the audience. I was a listener doing radio. So I would come to your house. I'd say, hey man, it's really hot. Who's got a pool? Okay. We're coming tomorrow. Or, you know, you do a party on St. Patty's Day down on the South Side or, you know, we were involved with the gay pride parade before it was hip to do.
Yeah.
Taking out a full page ad in the Tribune, and it said, "Is it wrong? Have a beautiful parade." You know, I mean, we were doing stuff before so many were doing it because we loved the audience, the South Side, man. You know, that's Danny from the South Side, and his congregation used to listen, and I still stay in touch. It was great. Everybody enjoys a laugh.
I felt like you were one of us, you know, talking to us on the radio. I think that was important. And you created an audience interaction that is reflective of what we hang on to social media today. You did it live on the air every day, connected to that audience in a very different way.
Yeah, I feel the audience was very comfortable. They could call me. I wasn't going to yell at them or anything. You know, they would participate, and they got it. They would say, hey, is Jim there? Yeah, and then, you know, Jim, I saw you outside last night. What happened? Why is your head all bloody? You know, they would just, they could poke that lion, and it did a nice job.
Now, during the Loop days in Chicago, when did you say to yourself, look what I'm doing, look how far I've come, man, I've made it in this business? When was that?
Oh, I think that was really early on. I think it might have even been my first week. I just walked outside the Hancock Building, and I walked north quite a ways. I didn't even know where I was at. And you turn around, and you look at that skyline, and you go, wow, look at this, or the view. You know, it was, I think it was pretty quick. You know, it was pretty quick. This is an opportunity. This is a great city. These people are, you know, the cops or the Bear fans. Chicago people are proud, hardworking. Don't give me a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
Just tell it like it is and make me laugh. Or, you know, I love Chicago.
Sure, Kevin Matthews is known for once having the stupidest show on radio, but none of it could be possible without the intriguing help from the biggest idiot, Jim Schertz. Stay tuned. More with Kev, Jackass Jimmy, and an interview that's so hot, it's on fire. With Flyer on Chicago's 50,000-watt blowtorch mothership, WGN.
Stay Flyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to radio legend Kevin Matthews.
You connected us to charities and stuff that, you know, you really, it was kind of frowned upon to talk about religion, especially on a mainstream station, but you found different ways to do what you did in the air, and we'll talk a little bit about that, about the book, but you just gave to everybody. I remember Sister Honora that you always support. I remember that name still today.
Yep. And Father Smith, and it could be the brittle bone, you know, kids with all these different diseases. I just always knew you have to give back. And I had a microphone, and that is a powerful thing when I can say, hey, everybody, let's stop for a second. Somebody needs our help.
You did that, but not a lot of people do that. Not a lot of people have that power on the radio that give back like that.
No, and it could be real stupid stuff. Doogie, my producer, female producer, I can remember she had to go to a gynecologist, and she didn't have insurance, and she was really creeped out about having to do that. And so in order to pay for that, we had a fish fry on the on the south side. Fish, get it?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
It was 2,000 people there, and it was a huge party, you know. Or we could all of a sudden, hey, we're going to do a big comedy jam at Alpine Valley. Come on out, and that's going to start all day. Or the golf outings. I've been kicked out of 10 courses in Chicago in 10 years.
I have no doubt. The golf outings, the proms, How did the proms develop? How did that come about?
Debbie, my wife got stood up on her prom, and I said, you know, we ought to do a prom. And so we just found a place. I said, everybody get ugly tuxedos, get ugly gowns, bring your friends from the neighborhood. And, oh, my goodness, those things were...
They were wild.
Unbelievable. We even had a prom. You know, I was... David Gates, you know, our prom theme was... Make it with you, David Gates of Bread. We got him to come in and
awesome.
You know, and have people dance to that. But I would take Kev Heads and get the king and the queen and the stoner, and the salespeople would act like teachers, and you all were the students. It was Kev Head High, and they just year after year they were great.
And I have to say, you had some of the biggest and the best in the history of radio promotion. All these fundraisers that you did, and you wrote in the book. That we're going to talk about. You wrote, these were challenging and wild years, a tornado of living, of loud, uncensored comedy, of concert stages and travel, of hunting and fishing, of Ted Nugent and the Chicago Bears, every bear, of making every round count and number one ratings, of Indian guides and Ninja Turtles, of the Bulls winning in the NHL, of partying and family, of prime rib and limos, and of making Chicago Tribune's readers best of poll again. It was one giant, big, big ride, but it was a wild time.
Yeah, it was. It really was. But it was a great time. And everything about Chicago, it wasn't only radio. Like I said, the Bulls were unbelievable. Television out of Chicago. You know, you had great news. You had newspapers and television and advertising out of Chicago. You know, it was culturally a happening place and still is.
I'm so glad, Kev, that you told your life story in this book. Really enjoyed reading it this past week and getting to know a deeper Kevin Matthews. What made you say, hey, you know what, I want to put all this, I want to put pen to paper and tell my story?
Well, it deals with the title, Broken Mary. You'll find out about that. A Catholic priest said to me, you really need to write this, you need to put this into book form. And that's how it all started.
You start about talking about, you know, your walk to school, hating your walk to school, not fond of school itself. Teachers really didn't get you. You didn't like the walk home either. And there's a lot of detail that you go into in the book, but I wanted to highlight a couple things here. You know, one of the big things for you was anticipating what kind of mood your dad would be in when you got home.
Yeah, because it really, the book starts, I think, when I'm 6.
Yep.
Years old, and we were living in Pontiac, Michigan, it was lower income, and at that time, like 1962, I'm this little kid, and you hear sirens, and you know the racism was, you know, the whole culture of segregation, and this new place called Vietnam. It was just a really not a fun place to be. You know, you'd have drunken neighbors and drunken parents, and it was just a jungle is what it was. And so when I had to walk to school, just even the people in the houses were so different and strange. And it was, as a 6-year-old, you know, where am I at, you know?
But you knew that at that young age that this was kind of tough. I mean, you knew it.
Yeah, it was tough, and I was tough at that age too. You know, I'd kill you.
Yeah.
You know, it was survival, is what it was. I was a junkyard dog, a puppy, but a one that would, you know, don't mess with me. Don't mess with my sisters.
All right, we're talking to Radio's Kevin Matthews, and there's more after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to the Kevin Matthews about his new book, Broken Mary, A Journey of Hope. You talk about your mom and your dad and your relationship with them, a very different relationship between the two of them. They always say from tragedy comes comedy. Is that where you kind of found the comedy in all this?
Yeah, my parents, like when I was like 4 years old, I could walk on my toes and talk like President Kennedy. And, you know, my parents would have their friends over and they'd be getting drunk. Hey, Kevin, come out and do your little trick kind of a thing. And so I learned that if I can make my dad laugh, he's not beating me to death.
Yeah.
So comedy was a survival tool, I guess. And, you know, if I told the truth, I got hit. If I didn't tell the truth, I got hit. So I just had to kind of go and just do anything I could to protect myself. And then physically, I got to a point where I could kick my dad's ass.
Yeah, right.
I said, "Don't you? I'll kill you."
Yeah.
And that's, and at the same time, you go 25, 30 years later, and my dad, I gave him his last rites.
Yeah.
You know, at the hospital. So you got it. The forgiveness is a really, it's people think it's easy, but once you truly forgive somebody, it's good.
You worked at a pharmacy, speaking of finding humor and everything. It was on Big Beaver Road.
Yeah, I'm like 15.
Yeah.
And I'm working. My brother was the store manager. I used to ride with him in his Torino. And I love the fact because I was, you know, coming to age of sexuality. So anything, yeah, I found out, wow, the store's on Big Beaver Road. And I would always tell people, yeah, I work at Perry Drugs on Big Beaver Road. And that's that culturally, being around people, earning a dollar. Because if I wanted to buy a car, I had to buy a car. Or if I needed shoes or socks, I had to do it. So work, I loved work because I could buy things. And just to be around the public, and that's, I think, a lot of the improv comedy started right there. A friend of mine named Ray, who worked at the store with me, we'd be behind the pharmacy, and, you know, a lady would come up to pay for douche or something, and Ray would say, "So, how's your sister doing?" And I go, "I don't know, man. Doctors don't think she's going to live." "Well, what kind of shark was it?" And I'd say, it had to have been a great white just because it took her arm and part of her leg off. And you could see the reaction of the customer. So that's where I really kind of started to do stand-up improv.
Yeah, because that's where you felt comfortable, too, because I remember you told the story about the comedy club and how you did all that, and just people listening to you and laughing and reacting to you and your timing and some of the silence that you would do between all that, that gave you some gratification. It was an escape, really.
I escaped because I was on the radio when I started to do stand-up, open mic night, but I couldn't, you know, say some of this stuff on the radio because of the FCC. And I can remember my first night, I got 3 minutes, and I just felt really in control on that stage. I was scared, but again, that junkyard dog instinct came back, and so I just moved close to the edge of the stage, looked the audience in the eye, held my mic, and I think the first thing I said was, I'm looking at the comedy club, and I'm on stage, and I'm not saying, I'm just looking around, and I go, "What a shithole." And it just got an incredible laugh.
That was it.
It reminded me of my dad's basement with the bad paneling and the drop ceiling. And so I just got into a rant about my dad and his stupid basement, and this club looks like his stupid basement.
But that's what amazes me about you is that, you know, comedians go in with very scripted stuff in a lot of cases, and you just walked in and looked at the atmosphere, and that was the entertainment.
That was it. And I can remember the first time on stage, my 3 minutes up, I said, "I'm Kevin Matthews, I hate you." And I just walked off stage. Man, I bet I can do another 30 seconds, you know, and eventually you work up to 45 in an hour. And it was like gladiators. This bar, there was no cover charge, quarter beer night, and if you weren't funny, they would kill you.
There are many Chicago broadcasting legends. Wally Phillips, Bob Gallins, Spike Odell, Eddie Schwartz, Orion Samuelson, Kevin Matthews. How did he get in there? Oh, well. Stay tuned as Kev answers more of Plyer's gripping questions. Kevin Matthews, Dave Plyer, 720 WGN.
Dave Plyer, WGN.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to radio legend Kevin Matthews.
Now, Kev, I know always been, speaking of which, a cross to bear. I heard Jim Shorts is now in the studio.
Yeah, I am, and yes, I am. And I wish you can use my real name, Richard Baggs.
Okay.
Yeah, but or you can call me Jim, whatever. I don't care.
I'll call you. I know you best as Jim, so okay. We'll go there. You said in the book, without me, there would be no radio personality named Kevin Matthews. Are you really taking all that credit for this guy?
100%. Absolutely. I'm serious. I mean, that's what I love about this book. It's the truth. And yes, I made him.
Mm-hmm. It also said that silly ass has no idea how I saved his pathetic radio career.
True. 100%.
How did he discover you, or did you discover him? How did you guys get together?
I was on the air at WFRT in Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. And I was doing mornings, afternoons, and he heard me. Liked it, and Greg Salk called.
What do you like about it exactly?
I think that I the way I talked, the way the people liked me, uh-huh. I was the voice. I was huge.
You were
huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not to sound like Donald Trump, I can't say that anymore because he says it all.
Exactly.
I was like Bob Collins of Fort Wayne.
Of course, the Bob Collins of Fort Wayne. You know, with all this election stuff going on, I mean, where do you see yourself? You leaning left? You leaning right? You in the middle? Where are you in all this, Jimmy?
You know what? I'm in a plane flying away. We're down to these two people. Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, please.
Yeah.
A half gallon of old granddad. Good Lord.
I got to tell you, one of my favorite shows was the Jim Shorts Cavalcade of Sports. Yeah. I have to ask you, was that the peak of your career?
Well, we did it in Chicago. It was before its time. We did 3 years of sports television that, to this day, John Roach produced it. You look at Dan Patrick. He copied that show. Or you take a look at, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I know what you're saying.
Like your sports stuff on Sunday.
Yeah.
They all copied me. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Mark Giangreco. Again, I love Mark, but he owes me a lot because he copied everything.
You've really held on to Kevin's coattails for as long as you possibly could.
Yeah, and I'm done. I'm sick of it. He can't walk, and it's like I can break out on my own now. I'd love to do a show on a radio in Chicago. I'd like to do Channel 9. I'd like to be next to Robin Baumgarten. He and I,
yeah,
we're very close, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, just the two of you, yeah.
Oh, big time.
Yeah, I think she's still single. I mean, there might be an opportunity.
Is she? No, she's married, isn't
she? No, she's divorced, I believe.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, please.
Let her know.
Yeah, please, would you?
I'll pass along a number.
Thank you very much.
Kev, I got to ask you, the Jim Shorts Cavalcade of Sports, that was the wildest ride of a program, and the work that would have had to go into that to really bring all that to life.
I had to get up in makeup.
Yes, you
and
did.
It took, we would do 10 episodes or 5 episodes. It was like 10 because of the makeup. It was excruciating, but at the same time, it was, and we had no rights to baseball or the football. So we'd have to get these old vintage movies. It was a lot of work, but
yeah.
That was John Roach. And we got, you know, that was brought to you by Miller. And
yeah, you got sponsors, big sponsors for this.
And that was on ESPN was the start of something big for them.
But that was your whole show. And I think about now, about the decks that you would have that to juggle for all the audio that you would shoot and stuff. And I think how simple, I think sometimes it's challenging now. I know it was more challenging back then. I mean, to put on a performance and a show on radio is one thing. On television is a whole other thing. But that's what you did every single day.
Yeah, and you felt like an octopus because your arms are moving all over. You're using a lot of tapes. You know, you didn't record anything. That was all. It wasn't scripted.
Yeah.
It was just, I learned how to use a microphone really, really well.
What did Larry Work do for you in your career?
Larry, I can't talk about that. I just, he's Italian, and I can't talk about Larry.
Uh-huh.
Jim.
Hey, Larry.
Boy, it's been a while. How the heck are you?
So you guys, you know, when Larry and the Deacon were running the radio station, Kev, I mean, this must have been, you know, this must have been awesome because you guys had all that. These guys supported you in whatever you did. Yeah. And I think that was the most important thing, right?
Yep. And, you know, Deacon was there. And then Deacon, he went out to California to, you know, start radio out in California, and that's he brought in his replacement, Larry Wirt. And Larry, I knew Larry was going to work right away. You could tell it was just in his eyes, that smile, that giggle, that laugh. I think we went up to Bears camp and had a great time out there.
Yeah, do you remember how we did your first contract? It was kind of late at night. It was bear camp. We pulled some golf clubs and balls out of the trunk of a car, and we saw a street light yonder.
Yeah.
And we each took five shots each, and we said, if anyone breaks the light, you know, they get to call the number, right?
Right. Yep.
I don't remember who broke the light.
I was going to say, who broke the light?
The light definitely broke.
Oh, it definitely broke, and it was a big parking lot.
Wow.
Light, and yeah, it broke. With just a ton of laughs, man.
It was not the best shot ever made to break something by you or I. Actually, that took place in Oak Brook at a charity auction when, if I'm not mistaken, Jim went up to his room, and we were on the 18T Oak Brook Hills, and we had a pretty big gallery, about 300 people were following you in Bonaducci, and some point you said, hey, look, everyone, there's Jim, and Jim was in the window, kind of, you know, hand and underwear scratching, and you said you teed up a ball. And Kev, look, you're not a great golfer, right?
No, I was really bad.
I think you find a 1 foot putt challenging, but yet you teed up a ball and you aimed it in front of the crowd. You launched it up towards the 11th floor and it actually hit the window Jim was standing in.
That's awesome.
Am I right?
And shattered.
Shattered it.
Wow.
Yeah, we got a big bill for that, and we kicked out of Oak Brook.
Thankfully, Mike Kenyon of Mike's Glass and Mirror Kaching was close by.
Kicked out. With Larry, we got kicked out of 10 golf courses in 10 years.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Once because Keith Magnuson and Bob Verde wouldn't get off the roof.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, it was crazy. Well, the first outing we had it out at your club, Larry, and I think we raised $210,000, but we only gave the charity like $2,000.
Well, yeah, that was gross. Yeah, once they gave me the bill, you know, there wasn't a lot left. And I said, there's got to be a mistake. I mean, there's no way, right? So I went over this with Kev. We like, for 2 hours, we went over the bill, every itemized piece. And I said, wait a minute. Here is a Long Island iced tea for $2,011.
What is that?
Right? And I thought we thought we found the, you know, the defect. They checked, excuse me, Mr. Wirt, I'm sorry, but Mr. McMichael and Mr. Butler ordered that Long Island iced tea, and they did it in a garbage bucket. It actually used 17 bottles of alcohol, etc. Yeah. So we actually, you got away cheap on that one.
These were some wild parties, man, right?
Jerry Taft won that event, and Steve McMichael during dinner threw his prime rib at Jerry Taft, hit him in the face, and then there was a giant food fight, and you almost got kicked out of your club. It was awesome.
I did.
But all the money you've raised, I mean, over the years doing this stuff, I mean, that's where that charitable stuff comes from. I mean, not a lot, as I said before, not a lot of people use the microphone to do things like that, and that's what you did, man.
Yeah. And it was just a great time, and I owe Larry so much just because he's such a dear friend, but at the same time, you know, I got fined by the FCC, and Larry just took out his checkbook.
I was just going to ask you about that. Speaking of taking out the checkbook, how many times did that happen?
It happened a few times. It was usually Mr. DiCastro's checkbook. I just, you know, acted as a.
But Larry always had my back. You know, he always had my back. People would call the radio station and ask for. I heard him say that I need a tape. We don't record these shows. I mean, Larry always had my back.
Well, there's more with Kevin Matthews after the news next on 720 WGN. Dave Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Chicago radio legend Kevin Matthews. So you found your calling in radio for over three decades, a great outlet for you, for who you are and what you needed to do in life for yourself. And you were back in Michigan after Chicago. And while you were on the air one morning about 8 years ago, you noticed something different.
Yeah, I couldn't move my arm, my leg. I didn't know. I thought I was having a stroke. And I eventually got to see a neurologist.
Yeah, what do you do? You were on the air.
You know, I don't play a lot of music. I did that day and just got through it. I don't know why I didn't honestly just say to the audience, I think I'm having a stroke. Ed, my news guy, could you call an ambulance? But instead, you know, I always put myself last on, mm-hmm. you know, health issues. And so I got through it. And what had happened is a couple of days later, a neurologist wanted to give me an MRI. And they found, they thought at first, they said, I can remember I went into the office, doctor's office with my wife, and she goes, I don't like what I see here. This could be a brain tumor. And if it is, where it's located, we can't operate. So you need to get your life in order. And it was just before Christmas 2008. I had about, you know, 8 days to, I kind of took it in. I've always been religious as far as my belief in God. And I wasn't afraid to die. But at the same time, what I didn't like was, what's my kids going to do? How am my wife, the kids, how are they going to be okay? And I didn't like the fact that they were going to have to drill into my head. So it was 2008. I was then diagnosed with a rare form of MS. So it wasn't brain cancer, but at the same time, I didn't know what this MS was. So,
well, and you said in the book, you know, you talked about being a kid in Michigan, and you talked to God back then, and I'll let people read really how that all came about. But, you know, you were asking for help, so you knew it was there. And at some point you said, you left Jesus. Jesus didn't leave you, and you really embraced God again during this time, because you knew he was always there for you.
Yeah, at an early age, 4. You know, I didn't know what this, I was going to this big building they call a church, and there's this big guy that'll protect you. So God to me was like a big brother. He would protect me against my dad or the neighborhood. So that's where that seed was planted. And since then, you know, I had always, you know, I truly believe in God and whatnot, but that put it into perspective when a doctor tells you, sure, you've got to get your life in order. This is maybe going to kill you.
In Kevin Matthews' new book, Broken Mary, he reveals his entire life. Except for what really happened at the Kevin Matthews golf outings. Yes, don't go anywhere. The Kevin Matthews celebration continues on the Dave Plyer Show, 720 WGN.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to radio legend Kevin Matthews. His book is Broken Mary. Now, Kev, you broke the news to your wife and your audience about what you were going through at the time, right after being diagnosed with MS.
Yeah, because I had left Chicago in 2005 to come back home to Michigan. Just, I wanted to just start over again. I felt like the shows are, I'm getting, it's the same old, same old. I know this is so cliche. I did want to go back to the starting line. And so in 2005, I left CBS and I came back to the station that I had success with. And in 2008, I was diagnosed with MS. And at that time, I'm still commuting because of the
treatments.
Well, and the treatment and the housing market. We couldn't sell our house in Chicago,
right.
And it was long, man. And I wanted my daughter to graduate from Hinsdale, and so it was really.
It was a sacrifice that you were making, really, at the time, and it really kind of told you what was important in life, didn't it?
Yeah, and at the same time, it was really hard to do radio. I can't stand, you know, for long periods of time. I can't sit. I can't do the heat. Your equilibrium. So it became, and I think the station owners knew, hey, he's not like he was. He's broken. And it just took its toll. And then 2011, new company came in, and they just blew me out. And it was because, you know, I physically could not work.
You were back in Chicago when you went to Queen of Heaven Cemetery, and something amazing happened to you.
Yeah, I got diagnosed in 2008. It was March. It was St. Paddy's Day, 2009. We had an apartment downtown on Michigan Avenue, and I had to go see a doctor. And I couldn't take the Stevenson because of the Irish parade. So it's, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, I had to take the Ike. And the Eisenhower, I just, you know, God, I just hate. It was easier to take the Stevenson, but that was blocked. And I got in my truck, and I'm going out to see the doctor, and I heard this distinct voice just say, "Go to the cemetery." And I drove a little farther, heard it again, "Go to the cemetery." And I just said, okay, I know what cemetery. I went in, and it's off Wolf Road, and it is the Queen of Heaven Cemetery on Wolf and Hillside. And there was apparitions of the Virgin Mary there years ago. We actually used to take our kids out there because a lot of the public was hearing about this. And so, you know, a couple of hundred people would go out, and kids could take pictures, and they would see these orbs and whatnot. It's just kind of fun. But I remember that's that cemetery. And I knew I went, got a huge cemetery. I mean, Al Capone, I believe, is buried. Mm-hmm. It's massive.
Yeah.
And so you turn, I knew exactly where to go, and it's this big cross. I mean, it's 20-foot cross, Jesus on the cross, and I was there. It was not a cloud in the sky. Nobody was there. I just parked my car, and I just walked up to that cross, put my hand on the feet of Jesus, and I just felt this water come down on my hand and my arm. Now, there was no rain. It was bone dry. And my arm just came back to life, still works. And I just knew right then, I just said, hey, man, I am so afraid, you know, help me. And that day...
You felt that embrace. Yeah, you felt
that embrace. There was no question about it. And so that reconnection of when I was four, and you're my big brother, protect me against my dad... Now it's years later, 2009, I've got MS, help me, and that's where this reunion became.
A few years later, you took a drive, went to a flower shop to buy Deb some flowers, and you looked over and you found something by a dumpster. Another life-changing moment.
So that happened in the cemetery. I'm diagnosed 2008, cemetery 2009. I'm working full-time. I've got Debbie back over in Michigan. I've still got MS. I'm going through treatment. It's 2011 in November, and I hear this voice again, buy your wife some flowers. And I was right by it here. I looked, and wow, there's a flower shop. So I pulled in. I got out of the car, and I noticed, I couldn't help but notice this dumpster. And at the base of the dumpster is a statue of the Virgin Mary. She's broken in half. Her hands are missing. She's covered in dirt and garbage. And I heard this voice again just say, will you deny me? Will you deny my mother?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And
wow.
I walked into the store and little bell, and the lady said, can I help you? And I said, I really want to take that Virgin Mary statue. No, 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 that's not for sale. And again, I heard that voice again. Will you deny me? Will you deny my mother? And I just prayed quickly, God help me. And out of nowhere, I just go, I'll tell you what, I'll give a donation to the Franciscan nuns that live around here. And she looked at me and she goes, I know your voice. Are you on the radio? And I go, yeah, I'm Kevin Matthews. Oh, I listen to you every morning. That was my door opening. I said, listen, I'll give a donation to the Franciscan nuns if you let me take the statue. She said, yes. I took the statue, put it in my truck, drove home. I had no idea who these nuns are. It just came out. It just spewed out. And that's how I met them. And this book is the story of that, my radio career, my life, my ups, my we're all broken.
Absolutely.
But we're loved more. And faith is real. God, there is no question God is real in my life. I'll never deny that. I can't.
Well, it's an absolutely amazing book. Again, it's called Broken Mary, A Journey of Hope. Learning so much about you and... I cannot tell you really what a pleasure it has been talking to you and getting to know you a little bit more. And, you know, I know people can find you, your podcasts are dahl.com/Kevin-Matthews, and you can check out Kev on Facebook and Twitter as well. And now that we've broken the ice a little bit, I'd love to talk to you again, sir.
Oh, please, Dave. And again, anybody out there, we are all broken. There are so many people that, you know, have gone through cancer or alcoholism. We're all broken. And this story, please read it.
It's inspirational for all. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm really proud to say it went number one on Amazon. And it's not the book, it's the message that I'm really wanting people to read.
Again, it's Broken Mary, A Journey of Hope. Kev, thanks so much, pal.
Thank you, bud.
All right, news is next on 720 WGN.